And the reason for both the transfer to management and I think transferring to kids is that with the planning they can do really through our BEI members, they can start to transfer the business sooner rather than later. They keep control of the business, however, until they get all of the money and achieve all of the other objectives they want to achieve. So that might be a 3, 5, 8, 10 year process of transferring ownership, getting the excess cash flow, getting some money for the transfer of the ownership, and then having a liquidity event at the end in which the buyout occurs.
Hi, folks. It's the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Dast. Quiet Light Brokerage is the leader in helping entrepreneurs build, buy, and sell their online businesses. Since 2007, we have helped thousands buy and sell online businesses. And now, we're putting our extensive knowledge in your earbuds with our trademark relentless honesty and a few laughs along the way.
What would you say if a guy walked in for an interview without a shirt and I hired him? What would you say?
He must have had on some really nice pants.
And now, here's Joe and Mark.
Joe, I don't know if you know this or not, but one of the advisors here at Quiet Light Brokerage, Walker, he's kind of a big deal.
He is kind of a big deal. Let's do this. Let's make a pact. This is the last intro and the last time that we will say, did you know Walker Dybul wrote a book and a best-selling book? Forbes and Amazon, all this other stuff. Because, you know, Chuck and I did talk about it in the last episode as well. We need to stop making fun of Walker. The truth is, he's brilliant and we're jealous. That's the bottom line.
Well, that is why we make fun of him, right? I mean, we kind of wish that we had that book to our name, and he is brilliant, and he's well known for a reason.
And he's being asked to be a featured speaker all over the country to entrepreneurial groups. And he just had somebody named John H. Brown, founder of BEI, on the podcast. I'm looking down because I'm looking at the book here. Brilliant guy. The wisdom that John brought in terms of exit planning and what entrepreneurs should do in terms of goal setting and looking out to the future and how to adjust their business as necessary to achieve their financial goals and their personal goals. It was brilliant. A great deal of wisdom that John brought to this podcast that Walker hosted instead of you or I.
That's right. You guys get a break from us this week, which is fantastic for you. I love bringing in outside opinions. We've brought in some people in the past who are also in our industry, do things that are similar to what we do at Quiet Light Brokerage, but they come with a different perspective than we do. I love doing this because I think sometimes with what we do, we can kind of get set in our ways and our perspectives, and bringing somebody else in who has a lot of experience in this space and seeing how they look at it, it tends to stretch you a little bit and stretch your viewpoints a bit to maybe look at things that you haven't looked at before. So this is going to be a fascinating interview that Walker did with John to see what he has to say about exit planning.
I agree. I've listened to it twice. Let's go to it for the rest of the audience.
Hi, everybody. It's Walker Dybul with Quiet Light Brokerage. Today, I have John Brown, who is the CEO of Business Enterprise Institute, the oldest and largest provider of exit planning education in North America, and the author of the best-selling exit planning book of all time. And most recently, John wrote Exit Planning, the Definitive Guide, Sell Your Business When You Want for the Money You Need to the Person You Choose. John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Walker. It's nice to be here.
Now, here at Quiet Light, we have a tradition of having our guests introduce themselves, because we believe that you're going to be able to do a better job than we ever could. And what I might do is throw a curveball at you and okay. say
that was never a good curveball.
And say maybe if you can tell us about, you know, your journey of, you know, being an attorney and then, you know, how you evolved to ultimately start BEI and write all these books on exit planning.
Sure. So I was the son of two business owners in Michigan. So I've always had some, I guess, passion for business owners, because they ended up selling their business and it didn't turn out well. It was an absolute bust. And this was when I was probably in law school at the University of Wisconsin, and I wasn't in a position to do anything because, one, I didn't know what to do.
Well, let me interject a question real fast. When you say an absolute bust selling a business, what does that mean?
Well, they sold the business to the management team for a promissory note. They retired because they're from Michigan. They retired to Florida, like all the people from Michigan. And within a year, the business had gone under. And they received very little of the proceeds from the sale of their business. So that was just a bust. It really affected their retirement dramatically.
Got it.
And at the time, I was just a young, stupid law student. I really didn't know how I could have helped them. And it was long enough ago that the term exit planning hadn't even been coined. We probably coined the term back in the 1980s. So that always stuck with me. So when I started to practice law in Denver, I really had a desire to work with business owners. So the law firm developed along the lines of representing closely held business owners. And we had about 20 attorneys, and all we did was represent closely held business owners. It was a different type of a law firm back then, at least. And
were you a transaction attorney or no? You were just
half the firm was transactional, M&A firm, buying and selling businesses. But the other half was a planning firm, and I headed that side up. It evolved into exit planning, how to design and implement a plan to allow the owner to leave on his or her terms. And that often would end up being a third-party sale, and so the M&A firm was active in that. But even more frequently, it ended up being a transfer to family members or to management. And so we just developed an exit planning process about that in the law firm, with hundreds of clients, and then never having a passion for being a lawyer, I transitioned out of that. I exited my law firm and started BEI.
Are you still a recovering attorney, or have you had a chance to move on from that?
I think my former partners would say I had recovered from being an attorney while I was still at the law firm.
John, what is exit planning? I mean, you know, what is the goal of exit planning? What is it? I mean, what is this thing?
So every owner is going to leave the business at some point. I think we can agree on that.
If they do it first.
Yeah, they may die, they may go bankrupt, or hopefully something in between where they develop value that's transferable to another owner, and they create a plan to exit the business when they want. Is it 3 years, 5 years, whenever, for the money they want or need, and to the person they choose, the person of their choice. That, in essence, is exit planning. And wrapped into that, then, is an exit planning process that owners can use. And BEI does not represent business owners. We train lawyers and CPAs and financial planners and so on to actually do the exit planning for business owners.
Yeah,
and brokers, and the good brokers, I should say, Walker. Only the good brokers.
Only the good ones.
Only the good ones. And so that's what BEI does today. We train and support other advisors throughout North America.
So I have to ask you, as coming from the buy side of the deal, hearing about something called exit planning, it almost seems to me like the goal from a buyer perspective might be perceived as the goal being to maximize the value, you know, and potentially some end gaming going on, or for lack of a better description, you know, is exit planning just kind of putting lipstick on a pig in preparation of taking it to market? Or no, is it more?
Putting lipstick on a pig is the broker's job.
Packaging it up. Got it.
Yeah, we're trying to convert the pig into a beautiful stallion.
Right. So in other words, what you're trying to do is address the sort of levers that drive value and build lasting value and build a lot more muscle into a company in preparation for exit.
You know, a better term for us instead of exit planning would probably have been pre-exit planning, because almost all the planning and implementation work must take place and be completed before you transfer the business to a third party, before you go to market, or before you substantially transfer ownership to the kids or to an insider. So that planning needs to be done now for most owners, because 80% of all owners, according to our last owner survey, want to leave their business within 10 years. I was about to say 10 days, and it's true for some, but it's 10 years to be a little more accurate.
every month I have calls with both ends of that spectrum.
Yeah.
Okay, so how should a seller plan strategically about their exit? Like, what are the things that they need to consider? Or you know, let's start at the beginning. What is the first thing that someone who potentially wants to sell their business should be doing or thinking about?
The first thing I would be really the first phase of exit planning, which consists of understanding what they want, both in money, when they want to leave the business, who they want to transfer to. Do they want to they want to maintain the culture or legacy of their company? Do they want to benefit the employees? Do they want to keep the business in the community? Those are all goals that owners need to think about. And then they need to create with some specificity. So, I mean, a quick example is most owners would say, if I ask them, when do you want to leave? They would say, oh, I'd like to leave in 5 years. If I were to come back in a year, I'd say, hey, when do you want to leave? They'd say, oh, I want to leave in 5 years. Well, that lacks clarity and specificity. So we would say, okay, oh, you want to leave in 5 years. You want to leave on August 8th, 2024. Now we can start to plan towards that. So that's the goal side. And the other side is knowing what the resources are. So in third party sale in your world, the potential clients you talk to have an idea of the value of their company. And that value is always quite a bit higher, it's almost always quite a bit higher than reality. So they should be coming to the transaction advisors. And this is what BEI members do. They have transaction advisors they work with all the time. And if a client says, you know, I'd like to leave my business in 5 years, and I think it's worth $10 million, so I think we can get started. The first thing one of our trained advisors is going to do is say, okay, let's go talk to an experienced M&A advisor, you, an investment banker, a high-end business broker, and let's have them give us a range of likely sales value. And it comes back at $4 million or maybe something in between. You know, we don't know as exit planners what it's going to be worth, but we can't do any planning. And I'd suggest owners can't do any planning if they don't know what in the heck they have and what in the heck they want to do. And that's the first phase of exit planning. And then it determines, is the final part of that is there a gap between the resources they have today and the resources they're going to need? We've determined all that using financial planners, maybe business valuation people, if it's going to be a transfer to management or an M&A business broker or an investment banker, if it's a third party sale. We know where the owner stands, and so does the owner, before they make decisions on what they're going to do. Usually that decision is going to be, I've got to grow value in the company, and it may take me years to do so, but not always.
So it sounds like number one is to set the goals by what is the number we're trying to hit and what is the timeline in which we're trying to hit it.
Right.
And number two seems to be, you know, working with someone like a broker to get a valuation on the business today, so that you know where you are and where you're trying to build to. Is that accurate?
Well, yeah, we would say the first step is goal setting. The second step is resource determination, but to do it accurately, like you just said. And then the third step in our exit planning process is to grow value, grow cash flow, minimize, do some tax planning. There's so much tax planning most owners can do that they're totally unaware of because their attorneys and their CPAs have never suggested tax planning to them. I mean, there are ways where you can sell the stock of your corporation, a C corporation, and not pay capital gains tax if it's been structured properly from the inception.
Amazing.
Owners know about that.
When we talk to, you know, our potential sellers at Quiet Light, I mean, you know, if we really were to boil it all down, there's probably, you know, seven different things that I kind of look at. And this isn't about Quiet Light. It's about you and the process that you've built. And my question to you is, what are the levers that drive value in a business?
So we have a whole part of exit planning in this third step called value drivers. And so we look at what are the value drivers in most businesses and how do we get this idea, the value driver concepts? Well, it's not from being a lawyer. It's from talking to the M&A community. What do they look for, especially private equity, in acquiring businesses? And then those value drivers or levers work equally well in selling the business to insiders. So two things. One is we focus on creating what we call transferable value for smaller businesses where the owner's in charge of almost everything, it may have $1 million of EBITDA a year, but that's probably not transferable because the owner sells the business, the owner goes away, and maybe the customers go away, maybe the employees go away. So a buyer's not going to be interested in a company where the owner is too important in the operation of the business. So to us, transferable value means the owner could leave the business today with minimal interruption to the company's cash flow. So part one, does the company have that? If not, we need to work on that. And the value drivers then are what we work on, which is the second part. The three biggest value drivers we see today, and you can probably comment on this better than I can, Walker, is one, having a top-notch, best-in-class management team. That's what most buyers like to look for because most buyers don't have that management team to put in place in the company they acquire. And that also means there can be transferable value because the management team can continue the business without the owner. The second thing is a diversity of the customer base or maybe the vendor base to make sure that the company's not dependent on any small group of customers or clients. Because again, those customers and clients might leave when the owner does because they're loyal to the owner. So that's a risk that buyers don't want to have. And the third thing I hear today that I didn't hear a few years ago is the quality of the operating systems within the company. I'm hearing from a lot of the PE firms, hey, we don't want to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more, to rip out the old operating system that's, you know, 8 years old and put in a new operating, state-of-the-art operating system. They want to see that in the companies they're acquiring, at least those worth millions of dollars. I mean, a smaller company, maybe they wouldn't expect that. I really don't know, but maybe you want to comment on that.
It's a really great point. I think that, you know, a lot of the sellers at Quiet Light Brokerage are, you know, online businesses, right? And as you know, I've bought over half a dozen companies in my life and sold a couple and I've done everything from manufacturing and distribution to online. As a broker, I really only work in online businesses. And the part of the reason for that is a lot of the reasons you're talking about, because a management team is almost eliminated. I mean, you know, we can sell a company for, you know, $5 million, say, and it's just one person, right? And then they've got a bunch of virtual assistants. So the most important person in the company might just be the hired gun that's running paid ads or something like that. So making sure that, you know, that management team can transfer is key. I want to come back to something you said around transferable value. And I wanted to kind of dive into that just a little bit, a little surgical here. And the question is, what it seems to me like what you're saying is that the owner can't be the craftsman in the business, whether that be, you know, I'm out hustling, doing one-on-one sales, or I've got some key relationships, or, you know, in the sort of like E-Myth analogy, I'm the one making the pies. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate? I mean, does that, you know, sort of core business need to be transferred to a different person that is going to transfer with the business, even if it means a reduction in earnings because you're paying for a new person on staff?
Yeah, I think that's for most buyers, that would be critical. Now, in the world you're in, the owner may not be that important. It might be the technology itself that's important. Then the owner maybe developed it and created it. Well, he may no longer be important in the whole process.
It does depend, but yes, go ahead.
Yeah, so that would be your world more than my world. In my world, which isn't, I mean, all worlds now, there's a lot of technology involved, it seems like. Even farmers have a lot of technology. So, but that would be more towards an operating system. They're not developing the technology, they're just using it well. So I'm not sure I can answer your question. Well, we just don't have enough experience in that. But I would say, you know, if I were buying a company for its technology and it was created by the owner, I would sure as heck want that owner to stay with the company because he or she probably has other ideas in their brain and I may want to capture some more of that. But that might just be a situational issue more than anything else.
You know, I think it's one of these things where I was recently talking to, I shouldn't date it, but, you know, for confidentiality reasons, months ago, I was talking with a potential seller who wanted to exit. And he owned a SaaS business, a software as a service business. Mm-hmm. And it turned out through the sort of valuation call I was having with him that he was the actual developer on the whole system, which to me was like, you know, this is an unsellable business, which is kind of what I'm getting at. So sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, you get the where the owner is the craftsman and that doesn't transfer. And what we talk to our sellers about is, you know, the person who's likely to buy your business is an entrepreneur, right? It's a business person. It's not a software developer. It's not even necessarily a paid ads, you know, expert. So mm-hmm. I'm glad to see that you agree with that transferability is all. I mean, trying to outsource and that craftsmanship and skill set to other team members makes the business sellable to begin with. It sounds like that's one of your first steps when you get
that would be one of the things. But then, you know, tied into that, that's clearly the case, is the owner before the sale. Let's say there are two craftsmen in the business that are really key to the growth and the continuation, the stability of the business. We would want to tie those two key people, incent them to stay with the business through cash, maybe stock bonuses or stock options, have them really have a reason to continue on with new ownership because they're going to benefit from it themselves if they stay. If you don't do that in advance of making efforts to sell the business, then the owner can be held hostage, in effect, by the craftsman. Because they could say, you know, owner, if I leave, your business sale is going to go out the window. And I know you've been talking about $10 million. And, you know, I think I'm probably responsible for at least 20% of that value. So I need $2 million. I've seen that happen, not in high tech, but I've seen it happen in traditional businesses all the time.
Right.
And so you've got to protect the trade secrets, the value of which is the value of the business. You've got to prevent somebody from going out and taking something. You've got to prevent your key people from going out and just joining a competitive firm. All that can be done in almost all states. California is an exception to this, unless they have ownership, which is something to look at, but you still can do some things and certainly motivate and incent them with deferred compensation, stock bonus plans. Those are all things your listeners should be aware of. They should be talking to attorneys and M&A advisors about how to protect themselves against that risk that is right there next door to them.
John, I want to ask you this question. Is every business risk addressable? I mean, in other words, it sounds like a lot of what you talk about and help people navigate through is, you know, essentially eliminating the sort of risks that a buyer is going to see when they come to the table to buy it, right? Is there anything that is just not addressable?
Well, I would say the thing that's not addressable is general business risk. You know, let's say you're one of your would-be buyers has just invented some great software for the quick print industry 10 years ago. You know, well, that industry goes away. Now, what is that worth? So there's that element of business risk. Again, you can take measures to try to be aware of that, but some of this is hard to foresee. But most other things within the business, you can do something about. Maybe not everything you'd like to do, but I mean, you can't prevent a key employee from leaving no matter what you do. And that may be a pure loss to the company.
Yeah. And where my brain is kind of going is more like, you know, in an offline business, probably the number one problem that I see is maybe customer concentration issues, right? In the online world, that usually is not a problem. Sometimes in SaaS businesses, you get, you know, one customer, it's a bit of a behemoth, but it tends to look more like supplier power, if you will. Like maybe you've got one supplier, right, that supplies all of your product and you're kind of a reseller for that. You know, I mean, I think it's probably easier to address as supplier power because you can diversify your suppliers.
That doesn't mean your owners are going to do that.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a good point. And you just have to figure out how can you mitigate your risk by diversifying. It could be vendors. It could be suppliers. It could be, you know, customers, direct customers. It can be all kinds of different things And you know, advisors are not necessarily the best person or the best group to figure that out. Usually the owner, though, can figure that out through some good questioning by advisors. They may know what those business risks are better than, let's say, a lawyer. In your case, you probably know all that because you're in the space yourself. So I think you'd be a very valuable asset.
John, what are the biggest deal killers?
The first one is the owners doesn't understand what, if they sell the business, what they're going to get and how they're going to get it. They go into the marketplace, they hire a transaction intermediary like yourself. They don't really know how much money they're going to need as a result of that sale. One, if they want to retire after that, I mean, how much do they need for the rest of their lives? Or secondly, if they're just going to flip companies, how much money do they really need to go to the next level and make sure that they have a reasonable chance of getting that before they ever start the sales process? So we have investment bankers who are members of BEI. And one of the main reasons they're members is that they've gone through that. The owner, they go to market, they get some good offers, lots of money, but the owner then looks at what he or she's living on now, and the proceeds from that will not support that lifestyle, even though it's a lot of money, and they drop out of the market. They taint the marketplace. It's difficult to re-enter down the road, and the broker investment banker spend a lot of time and effort for nothing.
Unpack that for me, if you wouldn't mind. Can you kind of give me an example of what that might actually look like with some?
An example would be we were dealing with one of our members is an investment banker in Texas. And he had a client who went to market, had a cash offer for $16 million for his company. So the broker or the investment banker was pretty happy with that. It was at the top percentile of what he thought he could get when he sold the business. And at that time, for the first time with a firm offer on the table, the owner looks at how much money he needed, net after taxes, transaction fees, paying off debt, et cetera, in order to support his lifestyle, and it wasn't enough money.
It was a surprise.
And so, he dropped out. So that's a real risk of doing it. And then, so along with that is another closely related risk, probably in your world as well, is the owners have an overinflated concept or idea of what their business will sell for. And so they either don't take steps to grow value, they don't take steps to protect the value, and they just decide they're going to go to market. They talk to you and they learn the business is worth a third of what it really is, and they've wasted years that they could have been working to put in the value drivers and other factors that would lead to greater value.
There was a couple of times where I tried to buy companies by going directly to the seller before the company was on the market, so to speak.
Yeah.
And, every single time they wanted 20 times EBITDA, just some huge number for what the value of the company was. So I learned pretty quickly, find the sellers that are already working with advisors because they've already gone through the hard learning process of what the market actually is, right? You know, you can want what you want, but the market tells the truth.
That's right. That's right. And working with an advisor, there's going to be better information available as well, right? They're going to have a deal book. They're going to have vetted some of the owner's beliefs.
Yeah. John, tell us about the four different exit paths and kind of like a brief synopsis on sort of the pluses and minuses of each.
Gosh, Walker, you have read part of my books.
I can fake it pretty well.
Did you just look at the chapters and figure it out from there in the introduction? And I get that. I'm going to rip those table of contents out from now on. So people can see that. The four exit paths, starting with the least used to the most used. The least used is an ESOP, an employee stock ownership plan. It's a great concept. It's a great tool. About 1% of the exit plans or members do use that path.
And this is where the buyer of the company is the employees of the business.
Well, the buyer of the company is a retirement plan, a trust in which all of the employees are beneficiaries. There are some great tax advantages in doing that, but they're relatively complicated. You need a business that has yeah, probably $5 million of value or more in good cash flow in a strong management team to do that. That could be great, especially for owners who might say, well, I really want to keep my business in my community, or I want to benefit my employees. I want the legacy of my company to continue. An ESOP is good because it's going to be indirectly owned by the employees. And so the legacy, et cetera, will continue. The next used path is sort of a tie. It's between transferring the business to kids. About a quarter of all business, all exit plans are members prepare written exit plans, are transfers to family. About 29% are transfers to third parties. So that's, those are the second and third least used. And then the exit path most commonly used is transfer to management. Surprisingly, transfer to management. And the reason for both the transfer to management and I think transferring to kids is that with the planning they can do really through our BEI members, they can start to transfer the business sooner rather than later. They keep control of the business, however, until they get all of the money and achieve all of the other objectives they want to achieve. So that might be a 3, 5, 8, 10 year process of transferring ownership, getting the excess cash flow, getting some money for the transfer of the ownership, and then having a liquidity event at the end in which the buyout occurs. So that's kind of the general design of both transfers to family members and transfers to management. Transfer to a third party is used about 30% of the time, and that's your world. And it's very, for a lot of owners, they would like to maximize the dollars. They'd like to exit. If their business is prepared, they'd like to exit sooner rather than later. They don't have family members involved. Their management doesn't want to buy the business. So there are a lot of reasons for an outside third party sale. And so from an exit planning standpoint, in our world, that's the owner's choice. The owner tells us the path they want to go down, and we talked about the pluses and minuses of everything, but then our goal is to make sure that that owner is able to use that exit path and achieve his financial and time-driven goals.
Well, and just knowing that you have options and the fact that you can outline it so clearly is a great roadmap just to start with. So, you know, your parents selling their business and kind of getting it all screwed up is a perfect example of what happens when you don't do exit planning.
Right.
Do you have a story from your past that you can share, you know, that kind of shows, you know, the benefit of exit planning for an entrepreneur wanting to exit their company?
Yeah, I there's a story that we often use in our training. We call it the Carl story. But actually, Carl was a real client of mine. I started working with Carl when I was still practicing law. He came to me. He wanted to sell his business sooner rather than later. He wanted roughly $5 million for his business. He wanted the business to become a world-class company. That was a soft goal. So I looked at his business. His business was worth maybe $1 million. Carl was the business. He didn't really have a management team. It was actually a manufacturing type company, a plastic injection molding type company. So I said, Carl, your biggest, if you want to grow the value, you want to maybe leave maybe 5 or 6 years and realize he couldn't leave right away, you're going to have to develop a management team. That's the number one weakness in smaller businesses, is they don't have a management. And Carl said, I get it. He was actually really a bright guy. I get it. And I know just the person to hire. And I thought, oh no, this is going the wrong direction now. It's probably his son, who is a bicycle mechanic. He said, there's this guy in the Netherlands who is the young executive of the world in my industry niche. And I'm going to go, and this, my client was like in the eastern plains of Colorado, which was a mile, hundreds of miles, I think, from civilization. He said, I'm going to go over to the Netherlands. He's in Amsterdam, a world-class company, and I'm going to hire him. He's going to come over and grow my business. I said, go for it, but, you know, we're going to be able to do that because you can't afford to pay him enough money. So we talked about how the new guy coming in could buy part of the company from Carl. And so that's what happened. We designed an exit strategy to enable that to happen where the new guy coming in, call him Wilhelm, was able to buy a portion of the company every year if the company hit performance standards, which were tied into the cash flow. And we knew if we hit those standards in general over a 6 or 7 year period. Carl could sell the balance of the business to a third party or to Wilhelm, and he would have financial security. So that's exactly what happened. Wilhelm came in, knocked the lights out. It's a fascinating story how he did that. We can talk about it another time. But at the end of 7 years, the business sold for $38 million cash.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Story.
It was so for a long time, I thought, well, Carl was just lucky because he happened to hit upon this boom and this technology at a certain point. But then I realized he was lucky, yes, but he never would have accomplished that if he hadn't gone out, sold 49% of the company over time to this person who did all of the growth and who, by the way, got half of the $38 million.
Amazing. That's amazing.
So that can happen. But it was in accordance with the plan that we developed. It just happened to work out extremely well. But I think it shows the value of world-class management, even in a small company.
John, I'm thrilled that you decided to spend time with us today. Thank you so much. How can our listeners learn more about, you know, why they should be exit planning or how to do it?
Well, the number of ways they can always go to our website, exitplanning.com, but we've just released a new video podcast series called Why We Plan. It's on iTunes. It's on Spotify. We've just released it this week. It's that new. So I encourage people to do that. The CEO of my company and myself have recorded 20 podcasts so far, mostly case studies like the Carl case study. You know, what went right? What went wrong? What might you do as an advisor in that situation or as an owner in that situation? So I'd encourage them to listen to that.
John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Walker.
Today's podcast was produced by Podcast Motor and the Quiet Light Content Team. If you have a suggestion for a future podcast, or if you want to guess the quote from the beginning of the show for a chance at getting a shout out on the pod, email us at podcast@quietlightbrokerage.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel and this show wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.